Well, I'd like to begin by thanking the organisers for putting on this wonderful event and also giving me the opportunity to speak here. I'd like to start by asking the very simple question, what would it actually take for us to one day be able to say that we understand quantum theory? Simple question. This is a question I've been asking myself for the last 10 years working in this area, and the best answer I've come up with is basically to look at classical physics, which is something that I think we all say that we do understand relatively well. And the question then is really, what is it about classical physics that gives us the sense that we understand it? Wherein does its comprehensibility lie? And I think that its comprehensibility, in some very deep sense, comes down to the fact that it has this tripartite structure. At the bottom, a conception of reality, the mechanical conception of reality, this very coherent and quite majestic view that everything that exists is matter in motion on some kind of stage of space, moving according to universal deterministic and reversible laws in step with the universal time. And that agents can, in principle, have complete, unfettered access to this reality. And that when this conception of reality is mathematized in a relatively natural way, obviously it was done by essentially Galileo and Newton, principally, then it gives rise to this classical mathematical framework, and that's become refined and made more abstract over time. That can be regarded as a kind of abstract mathematical shell in which we construct specific classical physical theories like Newtonian mechanics, electromagnetism, by adding in more information, more details. So to construct Newtonian mechanics, we need to introduce the notion of mass, and we need the notion of, say, gravitational interactions between things. So one needs more physical input to go from here to here. The main point, though, is the fact that one can actually move from a very coherent conception of reality in a very systematic way, all the way up this chain. And that structure has remained, as it were, it survived for 250 years in spite of enormous change in the focal point of physicists' research. And the top-level theory was changing, but nonetheless, the conception of reality guided the development of those top-level theories, and this classical mathematical framework remained essentially unchanged. So, I would claim that then what we're asked when it comes to quantum theory is something analogous. That is to say, we would want a quantum conception of reality over here, which, when mathematized, gives rise to the quantum mathematical framework. And that we would then understand also very clearly the passage from here to here. And when I'm saying we would be able to understand the quantum framework, what I'm talking about is that we would really be able to understand the origin of every part of this mathematical structure, which, as every undergraduate student knows, appears very obscure and mysterious at first sight. And even after a long time, still, as practitioners, we still look at it and may wonder, you know, what does this really mean? And just to pick on a couple of points, I mean, the obvious thing is that the state here is represented in terms of complex numbers, whereas in the classical abstract framework, states are simply represented by tuples of real numbers. So why this focus on complex numbers? Why is that? Of course, one can rewrite this in real terms, but complex numbers do seem to be really fundamental. Why so? To pick on another example, dynamics are supposed to be unitary, so they're not just one-to-one maps over state space, they're a very particular kind of one-to-one map over state space. So even at this very abstract level, the dynamics are being restricted in some way. That's not a restriction one sees in classical mechanics, where at this abstract level, dynamics are simply represented by one-to-one maps over state space. So one would like an explanation for this. One would really like a derivation of this from some very physical, well-grounded principles. To what extent, then, have we moved forward in this direction of really coming up with a conception of reality that makes sense of the quantum formalism? I think when you look at quantum foundations, as it were, looking back over the last 80 or so years, I think there are two main directions that have been pursued, neither of which have really directly sort of confronted the formalism. Some people have, and some parts of the formalism have been confronted, but by and large, when we think about quantum foundations, that's not what we tend to think about. The two main streams I'm referring to are interpretations of quantum theory. By that I mean Copenhagen, de Broglie, Bohm, many worlds, the usual suspects. And in all of those cases, the large part of the formalism is taken as a given, and maybe some additional structure is added. And the goal essentially is to try to clothe that mathematical structure in some sort of plausible metaphysical way. All of these interpretations have, in their own way, provided us with very important insights into the nature of the quantum world. They each bring into focus some aspect of the mysteriousness of quantum theory. But what we've learned through this process, you might say through this program of interpretation, is that there are just many different interpretations compatible with the same mathematical formalism. And it's actually very difficult to know how to choose between them. And of course, none of the interpretations really cast light on the origin of most of this formalism. Another kind of thread, you might say, in foundations, has been to try to almost do feature extraction on the quantum formalism. That is to say, to try to extract from the quantum formalism general features that we can get a conceptual grasp on, which somehow captures some important features of the quantum formalism, which we can then put side by side with the corresponding features in classical physics. Many of these you can read off straight off the formalism without too much difficulty, even though some of them took a long time to do. Some of these are very, very much more subtle, as talks yesterday made clear. Neither of these is trivial to read off the formalism. One needs to do an awful lot of work and make auxiliary assumptions in order to derive these. And of course, they're still argued about for that reason. And again, this whole program, in a sense, of trying to do feature extraction on quantum theory has given us greatly enriched our understanding of quantum reality and inspired all kinds of technological applications. But again, how far does this lead us towards this sort of goal of a conception of quantum reality? When I look at all of this, the problem I have is that I don't know how to assemble them all into a single conception. That is to say, why is reality like this, and like this, and like this, and like this? Why are these separate ideas, why are these separate facts all together true of quantum theory? Could there be a universe where some of these are true and some are not true? It seems more than a coincidence that all of these should be there together. In moving from classical physics to quantum physics, all of these things, as it were, change. So that's, in a sense, the difficulty with this whole thread. It takes us some way to understanding the nature of quantum reality, but there's a big gap between that and the end goal, as I've described it. So in view of this problem, it seems that we need another methodology, and there are more than one such methodologies out there being pursued in foundations, which is very exciting. The one which I've been pursuing for several years is this program of reconstruction of quantum theory. And the basic idea is simply that what we're trying to do in interpretations is, in a sense, problematic, because we're directly trying to clothe that mathematical framework in terms of some concepts. And it's just very difficult to do a matching between here and here. As it were, the impedance matching is just not good. And what we really need to do instead is to find a compelling set of physical principles which we can mathematize in some natural way and derive this framework. Once we've done that, once we've achieved that, we can philosophically reflect upon those physical principles, bringing to bear whatever philosophical resources we may have available, and then try to come up with some way of thinking about reality which makes it seem natural and obvious that these physical principles should hold true of the physical world. So this is the overall vision that I've been pursuing for many years. The part that I focused on over that period of time really is this piece of reconstruction of quantum theory. And it's something which over the last, say, 10 years has generated a great deal of interest, The first international conference in the subject, to my knowledge, was last year at Perimeter Institute, and we had upwards of 20 people standing up and presenting their own way of reconstructing quantum theory. And so it was fascinating to see how much effort there is going into that program. What I'd like to do is just outline my most recent effort in this regard to reconstruct quantum theory. And the reconstruction proceeds from the direction of Feynman's rules. So the idea is to reconstruct Feynman's rules of quantum theory first, and then try to reconstruct the remainder of the quantum formalism. By that I mean the von Neumann-Dirac formalism, to try to derive that later on. The idea, though, is to target the Feynman rules first, because the Feynman rules seem to be, you know, very simple, easy to state, and seem to nonetheless capture so much of the richness of the quantum world. So, Feynman rules have been referred to many times, but just for clarity, let me just explain what I mean by them, because there is some ambiguity there, potentially, which I'd like to avoid. So the idea in Feynman's original sort of exposition was, consider a space-time picture like this, consider a particle moving from A to B, consider all possible trajectories from A to B, and then you would assign an amplitude, a complex number, to each of them, and then say that the total amplitude to get from A to B is just given by the sum of those amplitudes. That's the sum rule. And then you also have a product rule, which says that if you have one of these trajectories, you can basically break it up into successive segments. And if you want to work out the amplitude for the whole, you just multiply the amplitudes of the successive segments. And this is what gives rise to the path integral approach. You're basically taking the product of the tiny little pieces as you go along, which ends up giving an integral. And finally, the third rule is a probability rule, and that connects together the amplitudes, which is, as it were, the theoretical level of description, and probabilities, which are the experimentally accessible things. And that's this rule here. So this is what I'm talking about when I say deriving Feynman's rules of quantum theory. Now, notice that this doesn't include Feynman's prescription for assigning an amplitude to a particle in terms of its classical action. Right, so that's not something I'm trying to derive here, although one would like to do that eventually. So now what I need to do as preparatory work is to introduce an experimental framework. Well, you see, the thing is that most of the work that one tends to do in that context is figuring out how do you work out this amplitude for specific processes. Whereas this abstract framework of Feynman doesn't, it simply says, well, you're supposed to know them or provide them. The analogy might be in probability theory. Probability theory gives you rules for combining probabilities, given that you know the probabilities for the join irreducible state, the atomic statements. So in other words, you know the properties for proposition A, B, C, D, etc., which are joint irreducible, and then it says, well, the probability of A or B is equal to the probability of A plus probability of B. It's up to you to tell me what the properties of A, B, and C, and D, and E are to start with. So, in essence, Feynman's rules are a general prescription, but then it's the hard work, really, in most physical cases, is figuring out what is the amplitude for different processes of interest. So the Feynman rules, or at least Feynman in his general sort of presentation, talks about classical trajectories. So he says, consider all classical trajectories. He's also talking often about particles, and certainly in applications, we're normally talking about systems with continuous degrees of freedom. Both of these sort of presentational biases lead to difficulties and confusion. So it's actually very helpful to operationalize, to take away this classical language of particles and paths entirely, and to move to abstract measurements with certain numbers of possible outcomes. And just for clarity and simplicity, I'm just going to talk about Stern-Gerlach measurements with, here, two possible outcomes, and in principle one could have more than two possible outcomes. There's no loss of generality here. You can talk about measurements with arbitrarily many outcomes, and the whole thing follows. So I'm going to consider two kind of situations, one in which the rings are separated, labelled 1 and 2 like this, and another case where the two rings are merged together. And if that ring fires, I should say that the outcome 1, 2 has been registered. And notice that the classical habit of thinking would say, well, if that ring, if that outcome were obtained, even though we didn't make the measurement, there was a particle that took the upper part or the lower part of the ring. Okay, but that's a habit we want to break. So in the notation, we want to make clear that this is a distinctive kind of outcome, different from 1 and 2. And this is precisely what gives us the richness, was precisely what gives us interference, eventually. So we're going to consider then experimental setups of this kind. So we would imagine, say, outcome 1 here, 1 here, and 1 here obtained, which I'll represent in this manner as a measurement sequence. And I could run the experiment again, and of course I could get something else. I could get 1, 2, and 1. And I could also run a second experiment where I, as it were, coarse-grained these two detectors. I merged them together into something larger. And I might get outcome 1 here, this outcome symbolized like this outcome symbolized like this. So what we'd like to do is just now build a calculus which allows us to interrelate the theoretical descriptions that we would have of these three situations. And to that end, I'm going to introduce two binary operators which allow us to combine sequences, these sequence of measurement outcomes, together. So if I have sequences A and B, which are the two which I just showed, I'm going to symbolically say that we can combine them together in series, sorry, in parallel, that would be the language I will use. So I combine them in parallel in this way, and then I shall symbolize that parallel composition with the logical symbol OR, okay? And it follows immediately from this definition that it has this property of commutativity. It also follows that it's associative in the sense that if I have three of these sequences, I can combine them together in two different orders. I can combine A and B together, and then I can combine the resultant with C. But of course, I could do it the other way around. I could do A combined with B and C, and that would obviously give the same result, symbolized differently. So these two symbolizations represent one and the same thing, hence associativity. And another kind of operation, which is perhaps simpler to think about, is I can think of a large experiment consisting of many measurements as really a concatenation of a series of measurements, a series of experiments, you might say. So I can think of this measurement and outcome 1, this measurement, outcome 1, so this would be sequence A, and I can concatenate or series combine A and B together. And I will symbolize that with the dot operation, so this is equal to A dot B. And just as before, this is associative for obvious reasons. So I can combine these three things together in that way, or I can combine them together in this way, and obviously they're the same thing, so that's associativity. More interestingly, though, we have a property of distributivity involving both of these operations. To see that, consider this sequence, which I could think of as A combined in parallel with B, and then I suppose I want to combine this in a series with C, so I can do that. And that I would symbolize in that way. But I can also think about this as A in series with C and B in series with C combined in parallel. And I would symbolize that in this way. Again, they represent one and the same thing, so symbolically we say they're equal. And this is right distributivity because this dot is to the right of these brackets, and then there's a corresponding left distributivity operation. Symmetry as well. So to summarize, we've introduced these two operators. They interrelate situations that we think are theoretically related. The operations have these five symmetries. So what's next? Well, now what we want to do in the most conservative way possible is to build a calculus from these symmetries. And we want that calculus to be consistent with these symmetries. Those of you who are familiar with Cox's derivation of probability theory might find this very interesting, because that's exactly what I'm doing. I'm just following that. If you're not familiar with it, don't worry. So what's happening now is that we want to find a representation of these sequences, capital A, capital B, and C, and so on, and then obtain a calculus. So how do we do this? What representation should we make? So here we have to be informed by physical ideas, physical intuition, and I'm drawing here then on the Borean notion of complementarity. And when I'm talking about complementarity, and this has been a point of confusion when I've given this talk before, when I'm talking about that notion, I'm talking about it in the qualitative sense that Bohr expresses it repeatedly in different forms in his work. So there he's not talking explicitly about the Heisenberg and Zeller relationship, or certainly I'm talking about mutually unbiased bases. He's talking about this very general notion, and I'm not sure quite how to express it the best way, but the way I express it to myself is this idea that theoretically, we require, when we're describing a physical system, we require twice as many degrees of freedom in the state, as it were, to describe the system. There are twice as many degrees of freedom there as which we are able to access through a given measurement apparatus. Okay, so that's the sense in which I understand it. And so I formalize this, again, I've given it a name just to avoid some confusion, so I call this information duality. And to make it concrete, suppose that Alice wants to communicate an angle theta phi to Bob, so she wants to communicate an angle in three-dimensional space. So she gets a Stern-Gerlach apparatus, she rotates it to theta and phi, she prepares particles in the up state, she sends those to Bob. Bob makes a measurement in the z direction, let's say. What can he learn? Well, he can learn about theta. He cannot learn about phi. He can learn about theta, but not about phi. So he's, with a given apparatus, he's only able to learn about one out of two of those angles. And yet we know, operationally, that if Bob is allowed to now make measurements in this axis, and this axis, he's able to reconstruct theta and phi. So there's some very definite sense in which, theoretically, to describe the state of the system between Alice and Bob, we need to have theta and phi there. But on the other hand, Bob can only access one of those angles by when he commits to a particular measurement. So there's that very definite sense of duality, in the sense that one commits to learning about one half of the information that's physically somehow encoded in the system. Just to make, again, this very clear, just jumping ahead to the answer, looking at the formalism, what I'm talking about is that Bob's measurement tells him about P1 and P2, but not about Phi1 and Phi2. So looking at the state description. And this generalizes nicely to n dimensions. So generally you'd learn about these through a projective, repeatable measurement, but you wouldn't learn about those. So now I want to make a representation using this idea. Very simple, I'm going to say I represent the sequence with a pair of real numbers, and I'm going to assume that there exists a function p, a continuous function, a well-behaved function, which tells me the probability of m2 and m3 given m1. And I've made some choices here, which I don't have time to justify, but these are essentially only reasonable choices to make. So now we make the representation, and now this is just mathematics. This is essentially just a mechanical procedure. So the O plus operation I had there is a way of combining the two pairs for two sequences combined in parallel. And O dot here is for two sequences combined in series. And so now this logic corresponds over here to this calculus, where the two operations, O dot and O plus, are defined implicitly through these relationships. So now we actually have to solve these. So let me quickly show you how that's done. It follows from a theorem by Axel and Hossu that given these conditions, and given some additional auxiliary mathematical conditions, that there exists an invertible pair-valued function f such that this is true. And what this actually means is that we can transform the space of pairs such that in that transformed space, the O plus operation is simply represented by trivial addition of the pairs. So this expression here. Then we can impose distributivity, and that straight away tells us that the O dot operation has a very simple bilinear multiplicative form, where the only things we don't know are the gamma 1 through gamma 8. And finally, we impose the requirement that O dot be associative. And when we do that, we find that we only have 5 possibilities, which I'm grouping as to whether they're commutative or non-commutative. The first commutative possibility is what we recognize immediately as complex multiplication. So that this is the first place in the derivation where complex numbers are just arising through these considerations. We also have 2 variations thereof. I didn't know about this when I did the work, but looking at the literature, mathematicians have known about these for about 200 years. These are called dual numbers, and these are called, I think, split complex numbers. There are more than a dozen names for these. They've been independently rediscovered many, many times, which is kind of interesting. And there are also 2 non-commutative possibilities, and I'm just doing a change of variables here, just to make the mathematics nice. So we've exhausted all of our symmetries now, but we still have a lot of choices. Now what we're going to do is impose consistency with probability theory. So remember, these pairs are there for us to be able to calculate probabilities, and under certain circumstances, we know what the answers should be. So if we consider a special case where you've got a series of outcomes here which are atomic, meaning they can't be split further, they can't be refined further. If we look at this piece, and this piece, and then this piece, we know that this should be A O dot B, and that this should yield a probability. Well, probability theory tells us in this context that this relationship must hold, a very simple relationship must hold. And what we can then do is to solve this relationship for these 5 cases, which is a straightforward exercise. And when one does that, you end up with these expressions here. And here, alpha and beta are undetermined constants, the constants which we have to determine. And we can eliminate the ones which just disappeared, because they only depend on one component of the pair. So it kind of violates the very idea of information duality. The outcome probability actually tells you only about one component of the pair. So we end up with these 3 possibilities. So we need further constraints, and very quickly, the idea to which gets us all the way there is you consider repeatable measurements, so using the idea that if I repeat the same measurement immediately afterwards, I'll get the same outcome with certainty, and using the idea that even if I insert a measurement, all of whose outcomes have been completely coarse-grained over, then repeatability still holds. And when you do that, you find that you can completely eliminate these 2 possibilities, and furthermore, you fix the value of alpha to be 2. And so actually that completes the derivation of Feynman's rules. So in the notation I've introduced, here we have the Feynman rules of quantum theory derived. Here's the squaring, for example, so it all comes out. So just to very quickly overview the derivation, we've used symmetries, with which we've given us quite a lot of structure. We impose consistency with probability theory, and we impose a constraint to do with repeated measurements, and that takes us the rest of the way. One can complete this program. I've done the last piece of this just in the last few weeks. One can derive basically the tensor product rule in Feynman language. One can find a way to introduce states in a completely natural way, which gives a Hermitian representation of measurements. And the thing that surprised me most is it's possible to derive unitary evolution of states without any further assumptions. So that surprised me greatly, because I was thinking for a long time, somewhat misled by the literature on the subject, that one needs something extra, one needs information preservation, but one doesn't in fact. So going back to this picture, if you accept all I've done and you accept modulo all the assumptions I've made, which you may not, But if you do, then from that point of view, actually these are the fundamental ideas, appropriately formalized. Everything else is actually a consequence of those two very simple ideas, which were known already early on to the founding fathers of quantum theory. In a sentence, Feynman's rules are a pair-valued representation of a logic of process, which is consistent with probability theory. Feynman's rules have the same fundamental sort of status as the logic of the rules of the calculus of probability theory. I'll just make one small point. Do I have time for this? All right, just to make the connection to the foundations of mathematics, which comes back to the title, Why is Quantum Theory Complex? You can play this game of moving between logic and calculus even in the foundations of mathematics. You could say, I want to generalize the real number system or real number arithmetic. The one way to do that is I abstract the symmetries of these, of this here, where now capital A, B, and C are just abstract entities. And then I can re-represent that logic in some general way. These, in this case now, A and B could be n tuples. They could be arbitrary mathematical objects. And if I do a real valued representation, I will immediately get back what's familiar, the familiar real arithmetic. But I could do a pair valued representation, and then all of the mathematics that I went to applies. And what you'd end up with is that you get this immediately from this, and these three will give you that structure. And from a mathematical point of view, then you'd have to still introduce another idea to zero in on these complex numbers. Mathematicians would probably introduce the idea that every non-zero pair has a unique multiplicative inverse. That's enough to do the trick. So just to put these side by side, and then I'll stop. Here's quantum theory. These are the symmetries. That's the additional input, as it were, from physics. And then we get the complex structure. In the mathematical realm, so to speak, we have these symmetries, which are inspired by our knowledge of real number arithmetic and the basic operations there. And then you introduce the requirement of multiplicative inverses existing, and that gives you the complex structure in mathematics. In other words, this is extremely pleasing, I think, answer to the question why quantum theory is complex. As you can see, it's basically because in both cases, these two structures have this block of symmetries in common. Thanks very much for your attention.